Welcome to the first episode of the Horse Traders Podcast. Over the years, I've heard so many stories about how people got started in the horse business, the horses they bought, sold, trained, taken to some horse shows, the wins, the losses, all that kind of stuff. My first guest on this podcast is Dale Livingston. Kind of special for me because I've always looked up to Dale. All of his horses have always looked great, and he has owned some of the best ones in the industry. And some of the stories he's told me about, he's just a world of knowledge about breeding, training, just anything. He's a true horseman, and I really appreciate him doing this for me. That being said, I hope everybody enjoys what we have in store for you. And the editing on this may not be the best. I'm not the most tech savvy person, but I hope you enjoy this. Thank you. I guess just start out maybe talking about how you started in the horse business and what to start with. I guess be the place to start. I'm sure everybody'd like to know that.
I can't ever remember not loving a horse. I just can't. You know, I don't ever remember. I just always wanted a horse. I was an Air Force brat. I mean, we didn't have horses. The closest I could get to them was when I was about 8 or 9 years old, I got to ride, a rent horse. Uh-huh. And then I ended up living in Lincoln, Nebraska.
We're good. Okay. I'll just check it.
I was living in Lincoln, Nebraska, and I was about 10 or 11, and I started going to the rent stable there, and there was a state park, Pioneer Park, and I would go out there and rent a horse for an hour. And in those days, you rented a horse during the week for $2 an hour, and on the weekends, it was $2.50. So as much as I could, I'd go during the week, right. And when I couldn't get any money out of my mom, or I didn't have a lawn to mow or some way that I made some money, well, then I'd save my lunch money, because 50 cents a day is what you had for lunch money, and right. I'd save the lunch money, and I'd rent a horse for an hour.
Go hungry so you could eat.
Oh, yeah. I just wasn't. When you're young, at that age, I was never hungry. Right. I mean, you were hungry all the time, but you weren't hungry like I got to have something. Right. And I just hung around the rent stable until they finally gave me a pitchfork and said, here, do something. You know, I was a pest. I just, right. You know, can I do something? What can I do? And ask questions. I was a pain in the rear. I mean, I was all the time just asking them about this and asking them about that. And the guy that was running at the time was a guy named J.D. Hutchins. And he finally just said, here, just do this. And, you know, at the time, I ended up working for him during the summer then for $5 a day. I thought that was just the grandest thing in the world. Right. You know, I got paid to be around horses. I cleaned stalls and saddled rent horses. We had about 20 head of rent horses. And, you'd saddle them up in the morning and put them out on that trail and maybe go with some of them and stuff like right. that. And that was my experience around the horses. And then I, you know, saved up enough money, bought a horse. Ended up selling it, making a little money, and went on from there. And then when I was 14, Bob Loomis bought the stables, or actually leased it, and JD moved away because he had it leased. And I started working for Bob. And Bob, at that time, had just started training reining horses.
Was he doing the rent horses too? Or
did he oh, yeah. Oh, oh, yeah. We okay. The rent string was the money maker. Uh-huh. It wasn't the training horses.
Right.
He had a paint stud and a sorrel gelding named Dirty Herbie. I remember that. and they were really broke. And Bob was really talented, you know, right off the bat training horses and stuff. But he had just started training reining horses. He had barrel horses, you name it.
Right.
And that's when he first started. This would have been, oh golly, in the 60s. Mm. And I worked for Bob for 7 years total, most of the time in there. There was a break a couple times where, you know, he'd had enough of me. And but he couldn't replace me at the time, so I ended up coming back. But anyway, that's how I got started, was around that. And I lived with a horse trader, a guy named George Phillips in that period of time. Smartest guy about a horse I've ever seen, bar none. Way, I mean, he could read a horse like a book. He was way smarter than anybody I've ever come in contact with about a horse. And traded lots and lots of horses.
What kind of horses? Just riding horses?
Just riding horses, mainly quarter horses. That's how I got introduced to a quarter horse. You know, I, when you just love horses and you don't know any different, I wouldn't have cared what kind of horse it was. I just wanted to be around a horse. It could have been a Friesian. It could have been an App. It could have been. Right. And I love all kinds of good horses today. You know, when I see a dressage horse, or I see a jumping horse, or I see driving horses, those Olympic driving teams are amazing. And just anything horse-wise, if it's done really well, I think it's, you know, magnificent. I was, you know, kind of had my imaginary set of horses in my mind that I'd go through magazines and pick out and all that. I think anybody that has ever had dreams has done stuff like that.
My neighbor growing up, she had Arabs. I used to drive her nuts.
Yep.
And I'd go through them. Even today, I haven't talked about an Arab in years, and I can still remember, you know, some of the bloodlines and all that stuff until I started getting the quarter horse journals, and then I knew quarter horses is where I wanted to
go. Well, and George told me these are the best horses. And he you know, I thought the world of him then and still do to this day. So that's how I got introduced to him. You know, I'm often amazed by the association wondering why people don't want to do this more or something like that, or expand it. Well, the only way they get introduced to this horse is by whoever they're learning from, you know?
Right.
And why they wouldn't reach out more to clinicians and horse riding academies and things like that in major metropolitan areas, and, you know, find all these old geldings that are retired and give them to them,
right?
You know, and introduce them to the quarter horse, yeah. You know, but in, I grew up, you know, learning and believing that the quarter horse was the all American horse. He's the horse that could do anything. You know, you could start off in the morning at one job and you could go all day long. And in that era, I grew up in a time when two-eyed jacks were popular, and golly, you know, they'd start off in the morning showing them at halter, and then they'd show them all day long, and they'd be roping on them, and anything you could put a saddle on them to do, they'd do.
Right.
And they weren't my cup of tea as horses, but they were good horses. They just, you know, weren't what I was after. But anyway, that's where I kind of started.
How did you... I guess Loomis more or less did the Rainer. So how'd you switch to the pleasure horses?
I didn't. life took me that way. When I went on my own, when I moved, this is hard for a lot of people to believe. When I moved to Oklahoma and Texas, when I first moved there, it would be like 69, 70, right in there. Early 70s for sure. You know, all anybody wanted to know about, all I wanted to do was ride Rainers. That's all I'd done at Bob's. Now, we showed pleasure. In those days, you showed pleasure horses. You showed Rainers. You showed halter horses. We did everything. Right. You know, his first wife had barrel horses.
Uh-huh.
And so we trained those too. You know, you just did everything somebody paid you to do with a horse. You know, and we very seldom had them. You didn't have horses in training long. I mean, we thought we'd really done something when we got where we had a horse in training for 60 days. That was a big deal.
Right.
You know, most of the time people picked them up and they went home and they went on with them, or they showed them and they'd bring them back for a tune up or something. But there wasn't any of this leaving it with the trainer all the time.
I remember the one guy I worked for, he had a guarantee, leave your horse for 60 days, you could take it to a horse show and win a ribbon. I mean, it might be a fifth out of fifth, I guess, but...
Well, but that's a pretty good guarantee. Yeah. I bet there's a lot of them wouldn't do that today.
No.
You know, but that we went along like that. When I first went on my own and went to Oklahoma, I wanted to ride Rainers. Well, I get down there, and a reining horse in those days was just a notch below a sour barrel horse as far as most of them were concerned.
Right.
Nobody wanted a reining horse. They wanted a rope horse. They wanted a cutting horse. And they especially wanted the grand champion and who won the junior pleasure. When you'd go to a horse show in Oklahoma, they want to know who's grand, stud, mare, and gelding, and who won the junior pleasure. That was the important stuff then.
Right.
Nobody cared about the reining. Yeah, I mean, I still had a passion for it, so I had reiners all through that time. But Jerry Wells sent me a bunch of Boston Macs to ride, and I got, you know, I rode them till I rode the W's off my Wranglers in the process, but yeah. They were good horses when we got done. But that, you know, pretty soon you get branded as being a certain thing. And in those days, I showed reiners. I showed pleasure horses. I showed halter horses. I had some good halter horses. I had Western riders, lots of that later on too. But I still had my reiners. But what somebody said I was good at was the pleasure.
Right.
So, you know, life will take you the direction, you know, if you follow it a little bit. And so you get notoriety in a certain area, and that's what I did. But I love the reiners to this day. I just love good horses.
Right, right.
I had a passion for the cutters too, like the reiners, but I never got the opportunity. I was never somewhere where we had access to cattle and all of that. But I still get a big thrill out of watching the cutting horses.
Right. What were some of your best, like your early pleasure horses that kind of you thought put you up there where you needed to be?
I don't know that I've always done better than I probably deserved, but when I first went on my own, I worked for some really, really nice people in Oklahoma. There's Dwight and Kay Van Dorn. They owned Van Valley Farms. They also started, I'm trying to think of the hamburger. It's a chain hamburger deal. It'll come to me. Anyway, that they own. It was like Hardee's and McDonald's and all of that. But why is that escaping me right now? Anyway, I went to work for them. I still had outside training horses, but I just moved to Oklahoma and started on my own. And Jerry Wells sent me a mare to show in the halter. Because he had one the same age.
Right.
And Jerry was really, really good to me. I would not have survived without Jerry that first year. But I had a pleasure mare named Countess Fran. She was a Skip's Count, which is a Skipper W bred horse. And she was out of a really good Hank H mare. And in those days, you know, kind of like even the reiners, you didn't have horses that were bred a certain way.
Right.
You just rode them, and whatever the horse had a tendency to do, that's what you did, you know. You didn't, you know, actually say, I'm just do this. You did anything that people paid you to do. So I had, but that first year I went to the Oklahoma State Fair. I had reserve grand champion mare. I won the 2-year-old pleasure Futurity, which that was the only one that they had. They'd have a 2-year-old Futurity in the fall.
Right.
And I won the junior pleasure, and I won the senior pleasure, and I won the reining. And so I pretty much had a name for myself at that. In those days, the fairs were the deal. The fairs and the stock shows. There was no world show. I went to the Tulsa State Fair, basically repeated the same thing. So I was on my own at that point.
Right.
I mean, I was kind of got rolling and had horses. I don't ever remember not having plenty of horses to ride from then on, you know. And it's been a great ride. It's been a wonderful life.
Who were like the guys when you go to the horse show, you're like, that's the guy I want to beat, you know, the big shots of that era that you kind of set your goal to, if I can beat this guy.
I can honestly say, I mean, I had the attitude, I'm going to beat him at this and this and this and this. The ones that I probably had the highest respect for, because it wasn't about beating them, it was about being the best you could be.
Right.
You know, now you would beat them along the way, maybe.
Right.
But at that early stage, somebody that I remember really stands out in my mind who I thought is an incredible horseman was Kenny Eppers.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Kenny could, I mean, he was a phenom. He could really ride a horse. I mean, he was like a really, really to watch ride, you know, right. Like today's horsemanship riders. He was so balanced, so centered, everything that he did on a horse's back. He could ride a reiner and was incredible on a reiner. He could train a reiner for somebody else to ride, which was always our job. Right. Then it was more train the horse so somebody else could ride it than it was anything. Yeah. And he certainly had incredible pleasure horses. I mean, the along the way, and Western riders. I mean, Capital Skip Bar was the first, what I called, really big-time standout Western riding horse. I'd never seen a horse lope along on a loose rein, collected, and changed leads like that.
Right.
Till then. There was other good horses. I mean, John Hoyt had had San Benito Bob and great horses along the way, but that horse really stuck out in my mind.
Right.
In that event back then, and of course he had Physical Ed and Super Damien, which wasn't my choice. I didn't like him near as good as Physical Ed, but I mean, anything Kenny put his leg over got better.
Right.
Yeah, you know, but he was a super talent. I always thought he was an incredibly talented horseman. You know, Bob was a phenom. He was just incredible. He just, with the reiners, I mean, yeah. He just, you know, Bob taught me to trust a horse. He trusted his training. You know, he didn't have to wear a horse out to get him ready to show. He trained him and he trusted him to do what he was doing. Right. And then he was, you know, really, Bob was one of the first ones that really started trying to find mares that were bred and did certain things a certain way for the reining, and then actually turned it into, you know, a breeding program way back before right. anybody thought about it.
Before then.
Before that, the reiners were just kind of, you know, you may want to do it, but nobody thought of them bred that way. There was a few people that, you know, there were the Gunsmokes and there were the different horses, the Continental Kings and
right.
all of that. That was even back then, you know, the King Fritzes and the Bueno Chexes and all that stuff. Yeah, they wanted them to do that, but we didn't think of horses as bred to do one thing.
Right.
They had to do several things, you know.
Yeah. I guess when I was growing up, looking at, you know, you always had the ad, I remember on the back of the journal with, I'm a big leaguer.
Uh-huh.
So where did all that start from?
Where it really started from was I was at the Silver Dollar Circuit in '70s. I'm trying to think. Probably this would have been the late '70s. And had a really cool mare named Kim's Mayday, and a cool senior mare, a mare named Only Pretending. And I was doing pretty good at that point. And Dave Page was there, and Dave Page was a great horseman. I mean, he not only had halter horses, Dave, back in the day, showed a mare called Lady Barbie Socks that was the honor roll pleasure mare back in the day. Uh-huh. I mean, everybody, Dave kind of same as me, you know, you get stuck in this
right.
brand and people don't think you do anything else. I mean, I am always amazed how people want to pigeonhole you in a certain category and don't think you know, pay any attention to anything else.
Yeah.
But Dave and I were there, and Dave and I were friends, and I had heard of Bar Passer. I'd actually seen him once at an open show at the Forum in California and remembered him when I saw him in Vegas.
Uh-huh.
And that's back at the tail end of the days when the open shows in California were way bigger and way better than the quarter horse shows, in my opinion. But anyway, I was in Vegas and David James had Bar Passer and was showing him in the senior pleasure. And I was showing Only Pretending. And I ended up winning the circuit, but there was no doubt in my mind that the best horse there was Bar Passer. And I really liked him. Dave Page really liked him. And that was back in the day when, you know, we went there to compete, but you didn't have a problem saying, that's the best horse.
Right.
You know, it wasn't all about the ribbon or the trophy. It was... I wanted to have the best horse.
Right.
So You know, I was so taken with that horse. He just had a different style and look and everything. The young mare I had, Kim's Mayday, that I won the circuit in the Junior Pleasure, was a lot like him. She was real elegant and flat-necked and and real pretty mare. And so I was kind of hung up on that to start with. And then Dave and I were standing there, and he said, you know, I've got Karen's mare. Karen Page, his daughter, showed a 100-seat mare called Karen 100. Karen 100 was a daughter of hers that I think won the youth world. But a mare called Johannes. Uh-huh. And she's 17 hands tall and was Karen's hundseat mare and was, you know, an incredible mover and a great big mare. And he was looking for something to breed her to that was smaller. And Barpasser really wasn't a big horse. Everybody thinks the Barpassers are big horses. He was bred big, but he wasn't big.
Right.
I mean, Barpasser was, you know, I mean, 15, one and a half, something right. like that. 15, two tops. He wasn't a big horse. He was by Senior Bardeck, but which was a running horse, and he was supposed to be a running horse, but he couldn't run. Right. Let's say he flunked out at the track, but he was went on and made kind of an impact, especially for a couple decades on the pleasure horse and show horse industry. They are cool horses, really smart, really sensitive horses. But anyway, Dave decided to breed Johannes to Barpasser. So he did. And when I saw the offspring, it was I'm a Big Leaguer as a baby. And John Mulholland and I went and bought him as a baby, and we give $25,000 for him, and he was an appendix colt. Mm-hmm. A lot of people today don't realize appendix. They don't even think of it.
Right.
In those days, those yellow papers were a little bit like saying, I think you have COVID-19.
Right.
You know, right. I mean, it wasn't a desirable thing. You had to go get, you know, a register merit on them to get your full-fledged papers. There certainly weren't any. And we, right from the start, thought he might be a stud horse because he is a big, elegant thing, and he could float around the pen.
Did y'all name him, or was
no? We already named him.
Oh, did
yeah? And he was just even as a baby. I mean, he was a baby. He's a weanling, and he just stuck out. You know, I'd never seen one quite like him. He was so deep in the heart. His cannon bones were so short, and it still sticks out if you ever see a picture of that horse. Uh-huh. He had cannon bones that if you put yearling leg wraps on him, they'd hang down on his feet. Uh-huh. I mean, he was so short, cannon bone. Hocks and knees were so low to the ground, and yet he was a really tall horse, really balanced, super short-backed. He got that from his mother because she was super short-backed for a great big mare. But he had that elegant look that the Barpassers had. And, he was just an incredible horse.
Yeah. And you showed him, what, 2-3-year-old?
I showed him. I had him ready as a 2-year-old, and he had a partial pulled suspensory. He belonged to me and John at that time. I later bought John out, and as a 3-year-old, I showed him at the Texas Classic and was reserved there. I was reserved at the Arizona Fall Classic. And I didn't show him as a 3-year-old at the Congress. And later that following year, in January, he colicked. Mm-hmm. And he was at the breeding farm, and I'm not sure exactly how it happened, but he ended up colicking, and Dr. McCarroll ended up taking 28 feet of intestine out of him. And at that time, that was unheard of.
Right.
There, it was just all black gut and everything. I was actually gone showing. In those days, I didn't believe in breeding a stud until you were done showing them.
Right.
And I already showed him enough that I knew I wanted to. And he was real good-minded. So I left him at the breeding farm, went to Arizona to show. And when I drove in, he was sick. And the breeding farm called me and said, we've already taken him to clinic. So I go there, and Dr. McCarroll didn't have a lot of hopes for him, you know, living. Right. And anyway, he survived. He's a really hardy horse. He's a special horse. And he lived for 3 years, had three colt crops.
Oh, I didn't realize he only had three colt crops.
Yeah, he only had colt crops. He had, I think, I'm pretty sure on this, I think he had 168 foals total.
Uh-huh.
Out of three colt crops. And he made quite an impact for 168 foals. Bunch of world champions he had, lots of honor roll horses, thousands and thousands of points last time. I haven't checked in years, but for many years after he was dead, he was on the leading sires list, first or second on the leading sires list of performance horses.
And, right.
You know, against Zippo Pine Bar at the time.
Uh-huh.
And Zippo Pine Bar had 1,800 foals, and I'm a Big Leaguer had 160. So
right.
he was really, really dominant. If we did the quarter horses like the thoroughbreds do, right. where they go off of percentages,
yeah.
not numbers of winners,
right.
I don't know that anybody would have ever caught him then. I've never looked into it that way. It doesn't make any difference. I lost my Flicka. He was my Flicka, you know? But he was, you know, he was really, I mean, that horse was so good to me and, you know, showed me what I wanted in a horse. And uh-huh. so, you know, I don't know that I've ever had one that I liked any better than him. That's right. for sure.
So after that, were you trying to find another breeding horse by him, or were you just worried about showing, or were you?
Yeah, a little bit of both. What got me into the breeding was I couldn't buy the horse I was looking for. I mean, I'm 6'4", 6'5". And so I'm a big guy.
Yeah.
And the horses that I liked the feel of were not big horses. You know, I wanted a big horse that felt like a little horse.
Right.
That's the bottom line. I wasn't looking for a horse that loped slower. I wasn't looking for any of that. I was looking for a horse that a guy my size could ride.
Yeah.
Was elegant enough and good enough mover that somebody would walk up and say, what is that? And I'm a Big Leaguer was that.
Right.
And, you know, he, to this day, reminded me of no other horse I'd ever seen.
Yeah, I remember that all the ads.
Yeah. And, when I see something like him, you know, that's what I like.
Right.
And I have horses like that today that are similar. They're not the same, but they're similar to that. They're unique. Got some confirmation, got some looks, got some size. But, you know, there's probably not ever going to be another leaguer for me.
Right.
And he was really dominant. You know, he was a prolific sire. He reproduced his traits, you know, of being good-minded, being big, being balanced and a good mover and just a really good attitude. So,
right.
He was a good sire. But what got me in the breeding business, what I started to say was, I had tried it a couple times along the way.
So when you bought Leaguer, was that your goal to have a breeding stud, or did it just?
Well, I wanted a horse that looked like that.
Yeah.
You know, I thought he'd be a show horse first, and I couldn't afford Barpasser. I wanted Barpasser.
Right.
And I couldn't afford him. Because I was a somewhat successful horse trainer by that point, but I wasn't, you know, in the position to go off and buy that horse. And I tell people that to this day, buy the best horse you can afford, train it up, sell it, make a profit, take the profit, buy an even better horse, you know, and keep working your way up. That's all I did.
Right.
I didn't have anything other than that formula and still use it, you know.
Right.
You can't go buy some of those horses that are those great brood mares that have had 10 great ones and all that, you know.
Guaranteed cost a lot.
Yeah, you know, it's like I've told you, I showed you two or three colts that are out of a full sister Divino. Now, she didn't win nothing, but she has really, really good colts, and she has the traits, the conformation are there, she had some physical problems, but that kept her from being a show horse. But the balance, all the traits that made that horse hers are similar.
Right.
You know, those great, great horses are individuals. Everybody wants them to be, you know, a carbon copy, and they just, it don't work that way.
Yeah.
Great horses are individuals, just like people or anything else. You know, there are going to be things that are similar. So, along the way, prior to I'm a Big Leaguer, I had a horse called Dirty Larry that was a wonderful horse. He was a world champion senior Western riding horse back in the day when it really started to become popular.
Is he Sonny D-Bar?
He was by Sonny D-Bar. I put a set of mares under him that were, he was great-minded and I mean really reliable. But I found with him, like the Sonny D-Bars, as a general rule, were really nice horses.
Uh-huh.
But they were really nice horses when they were four, not when they were two.
Right.
They were cute. All the talent was there. Any horseman could see those things were there. But it was starting to get into that fraternity mindset where everybody was aiming for a two-year-old and a three-year-old in any event, all events.
Right.
And, that horse didn't come on. I mean, I bought him there. I bought him at the World Show sale for $4,500, and he was 3 years old.
Uh-huh.
And back in those days, you were a junior horse till you were four, not till you were five.
Right.
So when he was five, he was a world champion senior horse, senior Western riding horse.
Right.
And was the honor roll hunter under saddle horse the year before as a four-year-old. And that's how much he changed.
Right.
From his three-year-old year till then. You know, that I bought him for $4,500 and he later sold for a lot of money. I'm not going to say how much, but it was well over, you know, 20 times that kind of stuff.
Right.
So, but that's how much those Sonny D-Bar bred horses can change from their two-year-old year on.
Right.
There were only a few of those Sonny D-Bar bred horses that were really good as twos, and they were always better when they were older.
Right.
But I put a set of really, really pretty mares underneath that horse. And he was, I can't put it another way, he was plain-headed. He was really pretty from the throat latch back.
Right.
I wouldn't have changed really anything about him that way. And he was great-minded. He was a really good athlete, mover, everything like that. And when the colts came, I was so disappointed because I put a whole set of pretty-headed mares under him and everything like that. And there was all these colts that I just walked out there and just, like, was sick.
Oh.
You know? Now, they went on and were really good horses.
Right.
The Dirty Larry horses, you know, they were horses that you'd see years later and they're still showing them and all that. So all those characteristics about that horse, you know, he produced, and they were really good that way. They were strong, they were athletic, they were good-minded, they were trainable. But they were kind of plain in the head and plain that way. And I went and looked at his mother years later, to Dirty Larry's mother, and I knew then where I'd gone wrong. Because his mother's head was on him and all of his kids. And I made up my mind from that point on, I'd never have a stud that didn't have a great mother.
Right.
You know, it not necessarily show record, but a great individual.
Yeah.
Because they're gonna go back to their mother.
To the mother.
And, you know, that it's held true to this day. You know, the mares, the mamas are where it's at all the way through. You find those good breeding horses, they're, it's going to be their mothers and their mother's mothers.
Yeah, I know in the thoroughbreds, it's...
Sure it
is. They don't even hardly care who the... of course, they want a good stud, but if it's not out of a good, great mare, good...
Exactly.
Life, they don't even hardly look at them.
No, so, it's absolutely that way.
Yeah.
But that's what got me in the breeding business. I wanted to raise horses instead of go buy horses that possibly in a lot of cases, back in those days, I was in a hurry for everything. But I found out that the quickest way to get where I wanted was to raise the kind of horse I wanted. Because I couldn't buy a horse that was 15-3 plus, that looked like I wanted, had the brain that I wanted, and wasn't screwed up. Because by the time I got a chance at him, where I could halfway afford him, you know, all the profit at the very least, all the profit was out of them. And sometimes they'd ask you way more than they were ever worth. So, right. So I got in the breeding business for that point. Right. I wanted to raise that horse, you know, and now I really like the idea that I get to see them all the way through. You know, I get to see them as right, babies and, right. and mess with them. And, you know, and very seldom do those ones that start off and you think that's a pretty good one. I very seldom miss on.
Right.
They make good horses.
So after I'm a Big Leaguer died, were you looking for one of his?
Well, I already had one. When Leaguer died, I had just bought a colt. I sold Leaguer Sandman for a client, and Leaguer Sandman was really, really a pretty horse. Uh-huh. Really pretty horse. Real kind horse,
big,
too.
Big sorrel horse.
Big sorrel horse. Yeah. And he was really kind, a good mover, nice horse. But he was out of a mare called Sans Miss Convoy. And Sans Miss Convoy was by Smoke 49.
Okay.
And yeah, exactly. And I had her and a full sister to her, a mare named Miss Windy Smoke. Miss Windy Smoke was her older sister and had been a really good show mare. I mean, I won the Sun Circuit on her, you know, first time I took her off to show. And she was really a really solid mare for all the clients that had owned her after that and everything like that. Sans Miss Convoy was pretty, but she didn't want to train.
Uh-huh.
So, even though Leaguer Sandman was big and gorgeous and all that,
right.
I wasn't attracted to him long-term-wise as a stud.
Right.
And he ended up selling for a lot of money. And along the way, the funny story of it is the man that had Casey Leaguer bought Leaguer Sandman from me.
Oh, really?
And I went, he asked me, he said, would you come look at my horses? I said, sure. So I fly in and look at his horses, and there stands Casey Leaguer as an early yearling,
uh-huh.
mid-yearling, some, maybe it was like May. And I said, how'd you get him? And I had turned down the chance to buy his mother at the time because I had a bunch of good mares. His mother was a Poco Pine bred mare that was a good mare. And I had heard about this colt because when he was a baby, he placed like fifth in the Kansas Halter Fraternity.
Uh-huh.
Back in the day when they would have 30, 40, colts in it. So I had heard of him, but I hadn't seen him. This man had bought him and owned him then. And I said, well, what are you going to do with him? Because here's this big, pretty bay colt, right? And I knew his mother was a good mare, and she was a full sister to a great mare I'd had back in the 70s, a mare named Katie Pine Lee that, I mean, was a mare I bought, I want to say, Todd, this is in the 70s, I give $6,000 for
her,
and I sold her for $25,000. Uh-huh. Now, $25,000 was a lot of money for a pleasure horse in the 70s, and I sold her to California, and John Jacobson had her, and she went out there and won a lot on the open show circuit when it was still going, and she later sold and came back to Texas and had a pretty decent show career here after that. But she's a big, pretty mare, so there were a lot of things there for me to want this bay horse. But she already belonged, or Casey already belonged to this man, and I said, well, what are you going to do with him? And he goes, well, I'm going to sell him since I bought Sandman. And you know, I didn't have the heart to tell him, well, the one you got's better than the one you just bought.
Right.
You know, so I did. I told him, I said, why don't you keep both of them, and I'll train them, and we'll take one to one fraternity and one to another and everything like that. Because I'd never seen Casey till I'd already sold the man Sandman.
Right.
He
so,
said,
so were they the same age?
Same age. Oh, okay, they were both yearlings.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that.
And you know, I don't mind telling you, he gave $100,000 for Leaguer Sandman at the time. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
This was about 1980, been in 86, something like that, 87.
Right.
Right in there. And no, it wouldn't, because he was in the first colt crop. and Casey Leger was a 2-year-old in 89. So it was 88. And anyway, I'm standing there, you know, and I'm like, okay, I just sold him this horse for $100,000. He's not as good as the one he already owns. How do I handle this?
Yeah.
And, he said, well, I'm going to sell him because the other one's better. And I didn't tell him he wasn't. I'll be honest with you.
Right. Okay. Well, hard to tell somebody that if you just...
Well, and, whatever. People have asked me why, and I've told them. I said, listen, I didn't know Jesus then, so I don't feel too bad about it, okay? Now I'd have to repent for it. You know, in those days, I just thought, hey, this is a good trade.
Yeah. Exactly.
But anyhow, I can laugh about myself about it. So I said, what do you want for him? He goes, well, what do you think he'll bring? I said, probably whatever you ask.
Yeah.
He says, well, I'd ask $50,000 for him now. I said, I can sell him for you. He said, let's do it. I said, okay. So I bought him.
Uh-huh.
And that's how I got him. And anyway, so Casey, I then showed him as a 2-year-old. There's a whole mess of stories around that horse.
Did he have the same, like, kind of look? A little bit as I'm a big leaguer, had a lot of the same stuff you like.
He was a big, stretchy, strong 2-year-old and could jog. He wasn't as good a loper, I'll just say it, as Leaguer was, because Leaguer coiled up like a big cat.
Right.
He was a good loper, but he wasn't, like knock you down loper. But he was a show horse. Uh-huh. That son of a gun, you train him up. He probably was always better in the pen than I prepared him to be.
Right.
Which is for guys that have shown a lot of horses, they'll tell you they don't come along very often. Yeah. There's a whole bunch of them son of guns, I don't care what event you're in, that feel better in the warm-up pen and get in that show pen, and they kind of leave you going, what happened?
Yeah.
Even if they win, they still may not exhibit the same thing that they give to you in the warm-up pen.
Right.
That horse always overperformed. He never, ever didn't show up. That was a tough year for me for other reasons that I'm not going to talk about. Right. I mean, I had friends that died and all kinds of different things going on. And that horse, I could count on every time you put a saddle on him, every time he went in the show pen. And, that year there were some really great horses out there. Investment Asset was the same age. Impulsions was the same age.
Right.
I don't think Principal Investment was the same age. He was a year later, I believe.
Uh-huh.
But, it was in an era when we had some really great young studs.
Right.
Diversified had come along. He came along after Casey.
Uh-huh.
But we were used to seeing really good studs. Young studs.
Yeah, it kind of seemed to go on away here.
Lately. Yeah.
Everybody kind of gelds everything now.
Well, and I don't know that we have people that are
looking to
develop them to be that.
Yeah.
Is the best way I know to put it. But anyway, there were some really good young horses that year. And that horse, he never got beat twice by the same horse. He was the world champion. He was a reserve world champion 2-year-old in the pleasure. He was the world champion junior pleasure horse the next year as a 3-year-old. He was the high point pleasure horse the next year as a 3-year-old. He was just a wonderful horse.
Right.
And he was a great show horse, and he was a pretty good sire. I mean, he was on the leading sires list for 10 years, and had a lot of world champions and stuff, but he wasn't the same breeding horse I'm a big leaguer was.
Right.
He was different. He was good, as good to me another way as Leaguer was differently. Leaguer was just that flick of horse. He was my partner. He was everything like that, and real sensitive. Casey was always my partner and could always count on him, and he was my buddy, but we actually went through some stuff together, even tougher things in life.
Right.
Than I did with Leaguer. But Leaguer was a better breeding horse.
Right.
I can say that because I owned them both. So.
Yeah.
And then Barpasser's Image was a really good horse, obviously.
Did you own him at all? Or?
Oh, yeah. I bought him as a yearling. I tried to find a partner for him at the time, and I couldn't get anybody to partner with me. I called Daryl Rodrock and Frieda Roan and one thing another. Now, Frieda ended up buying him later, but when he was a yearling, when I found him, I couldn't find anybody to partner with me. So I bought him myself, and I give what was a...
When Casey, after you... did you breed him at all when you were after you showed him, or did you just wait till he was...
Oh, yeah. Well, I bred him... after his two-year-old year, I sent him to Dave Pages because I trusted Dave so much. After what happened with I'm a Big Leaguer, I got real particular about I sent him, and I'm not going to say where I'm a Big Leaguer was.
Right. You know?
But I always felt like that could have been avoided.
Right.
Let me preface with that. But Dave is such a caretaker of horses, such a great horseman in his own right, and he knew that bay horse meant a lot to me. So it was a kind of a nice thing between friends for me. It was something I didn't worry about. And so anyway, they stood him his 3-year-old year, and we bred quite a few mares to him, and then I picked him up and hit the road. I'd moved to Arizona. Okay. I was already living in Arizona then. KC was after Barpasser's Image, right. I should say. Leaguer was before Image, and then I had Image, then I had KC. anyway, then I was living in Arizona in his 3-year-old year, and Paul Watson came along, and he flew in, wanted to look at horses, and he bought half a KC, and he bought a really, really good daughter. I'm a Big Leaguer named Big Crystal Leaguer that was a really good show mare. Mm-hmm. And he and then another mare that we had that was Big Crystal Leaguer was a 3-year-old then, but he bought another mare that was a 2-year-old named Kizzy Nostra, who was by I'm a Big Leaguer also. So, and then Paul basically made me a deal I couldn't refuse. He said, you know, if you'll bring the horse to North Carolina and stand him in North Carolina, he said, oh, yeah. I mean, he just gave me carte blanche, the place that he had there. And for 3 or 4 years, I never had to pay a dime rent or anything.
He was,
you know, like I said, it was a deal I couldn't refuse. He was very good to me, but I didn't really have any interest in moving to North Carolina at the time.
Right.
But so 1990, in the summertime, I say August, I was in, it was right after the finish for the qualifying, but I was in Rifle, Colorado, and I left Rifle, Colorado. Melinda had already gone to North Carolina and found us a house and set it all up and everything like that. And I left Rifle, Colorado and drove with a load of horses. I'd already shipped some of them back, but I had a load of horses on, and I went to Pilot Point, Pilot Knob.
Yes.
Yep. And lived there. And then KC stood there for 2 or 3 years. And then when Paul was getting out of the horse business, I sold his half of him to Ed Mulick. And that's how Ed Mulick ended up. And then Ed bought me out.
Right.
He lived most of his life up there.
So Rusty was working for him then?
Rusty went to work for Ed when he bought... before he bought Casey. Yeah, he was already working for him at that whole stretch of time.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. What were the... I remember, the Virginia fraternity, that was probably one of the first few times that I probably met you was up there after you moved to Carolina. Here and there. I remember some of them 2-year-olds that you were showing. I guess they were KC's. Trying to think. Was there a KC's Bay Leaguer maybe?
There was a KC's Bay
Lady.
There was a KC's Bay Lady, but I sold her to Rusty as a 2-year-old. You're probably thinking, I had a couple other leaguers that I showed first after I moved there. I had Leaguer Shadow, who I ended up selling to some people in Michigan, and Shorty Parks hauled him that next year. Right, he was the honor roll pleasure horse. Then I also had Leaguer's Last was a bay horse that I showed.
That might have been, I showed him up there.
About. Yes, and he was a really nice horse. He's a pretty bay horse, and was out of a really good mare that didn't show, but it was a mare that I had tried to buy from Brad and Kelly McCamey as a 2-year-old that was super talented. She never got showed for whatever reason, but the Leaguer's Last was out of her. Right. And he was kind of a nice horse. I mean, I think he's been a decent breeding horse. He's, I know he's like in the pedigree of Open Range and stuff like that. So, you know, I see some of those pedigrees and I see different horses pop up. And
right, they used to have here and there.
Yeah, it's fun to see the characteristics in them anyway.
So what, I know you don't need to give prices and stuff like that, but some of your best horse trading stories, kind of a few of them, maybe. I'm sure you've had several.
Oh, you know, we've all had several. I mean, Dirty Larry's probably as good a one as I've ever had, you know. I mean, on that, just that he could be in an auction. I like to tell people that, you know, when they, I'm kind of amazed that today people do things by committee, it seems like.
Right.
You know, they go off and they look at a horse for sale. They got to ask 5 other people, what do you think? And all of these other kind of opinions. I guess I'm just surprised by that because that just wasn't, you know, the group that I grew up with and respect a great deal. I don't want to say I don't respect anybody else today, but you know, you had what we called an eye for a horse, and it basically you learned it either through hard knocks or losing money.
I mean,
the reason you didn't buy one that was made a certain way was because, you know, he had a curb. Most people today don't know what a curb is on a horse, you know? And you know, just I can think of different horses I had over the years that, yeah, maybe they made money, but I mean, it stuck out in my head. I didn't want another one had a hock made like that because I didn't like them being sore from the curbs.
Right.
You know, and you very seldom see a curb today either because our horses are better in many cases. But some of the physical makeup of the horses that causes the lack of longevity and soundness, that's never changed.
Yeah.
That's been there all along. I'm amazed. I go look at certain, you know, I'll look at a horse and I'll think, what the flip were they thinking? Because this is going to be a problem. I don't care how good your vet is.
Right.
You know, we didn't used to have vet. We didn't even x-ray horses.
Yeah.
You know, when I first started buying horses, we never thought of x-raying a horse.
A friend of mine, I was talking to him, I don't know, a year ago about, he used to show a lot of reiners. He doesn't even ride anymore. And he said, hell, we never injected nothing, never took it to a vet, never gave it supplements, anything. We'd feed it grain and go out and spur it a little harder or go a little faster.
Well, I've laughed at people that asked me, what did you used to do when you had one that didn't jog good? And I told them, I said, well, usually we just spurred it.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm making light of it. It's so much better today than it used to be. But in some cases, we have allowed technology to blind us as horsemen. You know, the technology can, I mean, in the veterinary stage, has covered up faults that horses have or weaknesses that horses have that you as a breeder, my trade is a horseman. I think of myself as a horseman way more than I think of as a horse trainer or a horse trader. I mean, I've always traded horses and sold horses, but I'm a horseman. I don't care what breed a horse it is. Yeah. When their bone column isn't straight and they don't have good feet, probably not going to have good longevity.
Right.
Okay. And, you know, I tell people lots of times today, we've bred horses that for whatever discipline you're doing, I don't care if you're on a hunter or you're on a pleasure horse or you're on a reiner or whatever, these horses are bred to do this.
Yeah.
It's not like it used to be. The tendencies and of what we want them to do in the show arena, they're born with.
Yeah.
They're, I mean, they are good movers. They're athletic. I don't get into slow. I think slow is a stupid statement because it's not a physical characteristic. Movement is a physical characteristic. And if I think you can teach a horse to do anything if you're willing to take the time to do it. It's the ones that are physically really talented at doing that that stand out.
Right.
You can teach a burro to do stuff, and some whatever their job is, it may be better than a horse would be at.
Yeah.
But my point is this: now that you can inject and you this and you that, you know, young people with horses, because I won't call them horsemen yet. Young people with horses, in many cases, they don't even recognize a wind puff or a swelling on an ankle or whatever thing. I mean, before we ever saddled a horse, before we really even got a horse out of a stall, you looked at all four legs on them before you took them out and saddled them. Mm-hmm. And when you saddled them, certainly before you put splint boots on them or anything, you would recognize whether they had a swollen spot that they didn't have the day before. Well, that's an indicator.
Right.
You know, that tells you something's, you've either stressed the horse or he has a weakness. And, you know, we've bred these horses up to where they, for the most part, physically can do their job, and they're reasonably good-minded. Some are great-minded. But, you know, what makes them not want to do it and become a problem in training is pain.
Right.
You know, it's like people ask me, they say, well, you know, what made you quit riding? And I told them, I said, I never quit riding, or I never quit wanting to ride. But when, you know, there was a period of time I couldn't ride for 5 years, the doctor said, that's it, you can't ride. Right. We can't put you back together anymore. Well, I never lost my desire to ride, but what will make you lose your desire is when it's more painful than it is anything.
Right.
Well, it's the same way with a horse. These young horses start off and they want to do what you want them to do, but when it starts hurting them, either physically or whatever you're doing to them, they aren't going to want to do it. And that's where our job as a horseman in making sure that we breed and raise individuals that have good feet, good bone, good physical structure, and all those things. That's what being a horseman is to me.
You think it makes a difference? You know, you talked about before where you did halter horses, pleasure, reiners, barrel horses. Nowadays, everybody's so specialized. I mean, I'm sure some of the, not to talk about younger guys or whatever, but you know, now you come out, you don't do all that stuff. If you go to work for somebody, you know.
Well, they go to medical school and they become whatever. They become, you know, if the guy is a specialist in viruses,
right.
He's not going to see you for something, some other ailment.
Right.
Or, you know, we see it even in the veterinary business. Now you see it in the different things with the horses. You know, they do this, that's all they see. But we don't turn out necessarily good horsemen that way.
Right.
It's not to say they're not experienced or they're not good at what they do. They are.
Might not have but the rounded when, education. That
well, you when you don't, when we, it, here's the thing. Horsemen.
We can stop that if you need to.
Hey, baby.
All right. I guess we're back on now.
The specialization makes, we have way, way more knowledge is what I see. I'm amazed at how you can go on YouTube and see how to do anything with a horse. I think, when I was a kid, what I'd have done for that. Yeah. I can remember sitting in the stands in the Coliseum at the Congress all night long, watching guys ride, trying to pick up this or that. You know, that's how you learned. And now the knowledge, the information is there, you know, whether you can soak it up or not is a whole nother thing,
right.
But the information's there. There's nobody keeping anything back. And yet some information doesn't get passed around, like, you know, those general things, you know, what I call horseman things. And yet horsemen share with other horsemen. You know, that's one of the things I love the most about the horse business is it's a family. You know, we got some crazy cousins in the family, but they're still family.
Right.
You know,
right.
If they ask for help, right, you're going to help them. Yep. You know, you're going to give them information. You know, I mean, horsemen will go, you know, we can be competing and a horseman will go, Dale, have you ever tried this bridle? Uh-huh. Have you ever tried this? I don't have a problem at all calling up, you know, people, whether, you know, Benny Gatrone used to be my go-to guy when I was in a jam and couldn't, right, you know, when I had, you know, brain freeze or something, right, with a problem on a horse. Bobby Avila and I've always swapped ideas, yeah, and, you know, I don't consider myself less for asking, and nor, yeah, would he,
yeah,
you know.
Well, sometimes it looks like it can even be just a little, some little different or.
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing is, it
might not be a reinventing a wheel, just something you might have forgot to do or.
You know, the closer you are to the problem, yeah, usually the less you see, yeah, exactly where it's at. You're focusing so much on the problem that you're not seeing the cause. You know, I relate it like this. You know, if you walk down the barn aisleway, there's a crack in that concrete down there in about halfway down the barn aisleway.
Right.
You know, after about a week, you don't even notice that crack.
Right.
But now somebody that's coming in to look
first
at it, yeah, and they're thinking about buying this barn.
Yeah.
They see it right off the bat.
Right.
And that's kind of how it is sometimes with horsemen, with horses. If you have another horseman, you know, and you trust them, you know, you can have them watch the horse and they can share what they, yeah, see with you. And you go, why didn't I see that? You know, you're thinking, for instance, it's the front end. It, yeah, ain't the front end. It's, right, the back end. You're thinking it's the right side. No, his left rib's out.
Yeah.
You know, it's so much of the times with horses, it's that way. That's where, you know, having access or being around other people. The Bible says iron sharpens iron. So, you know, when you see these guys, you know, competitors that ride, or good horsemen that ride around one another, mm-hmm, they sharpen each other.
Right.
You know, one picks up off the other one picks up off of. They don't have to do everything the same.
Right.
To be, it doesn't mean one's right and one's wrong. You know, everybody has a little different way with a horse. And especially, you know, people that are as deep into it as you know, horsemen are. You know, I mean, that's what we live and breathe as horses. Right. So, you know, that outside eye, that viewpoint, I don't care if it's the vet, the farrier, whatever, you know, but the certain basics work, you know, balance in a horse and the things that you look for in a horse and good bone, good nutrition. You know, I'm always amazed by the quarter horse people that don't take into consideration when they buy a young horse where it was raised.
Right.
You know, in the thoroughbred business, you're not going to see one of those things bring lots and lots of money as a young prospect that didn't come out of one of those farms.
Yeah.
That they know they do this, they were wormed, they were this, they were that, they had all the supplements, they had all the things that they deserved to have, you know, besides good x-rays.
Right.
You know, and those things count. You know, I'm always amazed that, you know, you see people that don't have a good worming schedule, don't take care of their teeth, don't do the other things like that. That doesn't mean that the horse isn't a pretty good horse.
Yeah.
He may be good in spite of him, not because of him.
Right.
But
right.
That won't keep him from colicking when he's 8 years old after he's got all these years of training in him because he wasn't wormed as a baby and he has all these adhesions and,
yeah,
and you know, weaknesses,
yep,
in his intestinal tract. Just little things like that. Once you know that as a horseman, I feel like you're obligated to take care of him.
Right.
You know, if you don't know it, that's different.
Right.
You know, yeah, but once you know it, if you call yourself a horseman, you're obligated to take care of them. It doesn't mean you're obligated to keep them, you know, roly-poly fat.
Right.
That's not necessarily taking care of them.
Yeah.
It's the other things, you know, care of their feet. You don't have to shoe them all, but you ought to get them all trimmed good.
Right.
You know, you ought to keep things in order. A lot of those joint problems can be avoided there. But anyway, I know we're way off track. I'm chasing a rabbit.
Oh, that's all right. Let's go back to your life. How about after you left North Carolina? What when you left there, where did you?
Two major things happened. When I went to North Carolina, I loved North Carolina. The North Carolina people were wonderful to me. I've got so many great memories there. Casey was very productive, did very well. But probably the most important thing was for me in my life was that I came to the Lord in 1990. And it was because of that bay horse. I was at the World Show. I met the Lord. And I've tried to live a life of faith. And since, that's the best thing that ever happened in my life. Outside of my wife and then my family and my wonderful horses that I've been blessed to have all my life. But that changed a lot. About 97, I moved to Oklahoma. Uh-huh. I had sold Casey Leaguer, and I wanted to be closer to the World Shows. Oklahoma City and Fort Worth were where the World Shows were at. Right. So I love where I'm at now in South Texas. Uh-huh. I wanted to come here. But it wasn't handy. It's still not really handy.
Right.
But I still love it more than any place I've ever lived. But I felt like in between Fort Worth and Oklahoma City was the perfect place to be if you were in the horse business. Yeah. The Western stock horse business, quarter horses and stuff. So I built a place in Marietta, Oklahoma, and started from scratch, with 80 acres and built a barn and a home and one thing and another, and it was fun to go through the whole deal and build it and all that. I wouldn't do it again on a bet. I wasted a lot of time that I should have spent on horses, and I was spending. I always encourage young guys, if you're a horse trainer, you want to ride horses.
Yeah.
You don't want to haul hay. You don't want
to
ride horses. So put yourself in a position where you can ride horses. That's your trade. If you're a lesson giver, go somewhere where you can give lessons. You know, there's nothing wrong. I'm not saying you shouldn't own a piece of property if that's what you want to do, if that's your dream. But I couldn't do that without taking away from the horse part of it.
Right.
And so I feel like I lost 10 years. And then I had an accident while I was there that cost me another 5 years. So 15 years in my way of thinking of when I would have been more productive on a horse, I wished I had, was taken away. That's just advice. That's not, it doesn't mean it's right for everybody. It's just, I tell a lot of young guys, if you can find a good place to work and make money and you don't have to own everything.
Right.
In some cases you have to so that you can do this or something. But anyway, went to Oklahoma. Then I got hurt and had to sell the ranch and one thing another. I ended up coming to South Texas by way of Las Vegas. Cause at the time we were just kind of making ends meet and one thing another. Melinda was working in Vegas for a custom appliance deal. She's really good in home decoration and all kinds of stuff like that. Anyway, and I was just judging shows, so it didn't make any difference. In fact, Vegas was great because you could fly out of there to any place, especially in those days. And then I had the opportunity to come down here to South Texas, and I took it, and I love it. And, been here since, I think, 2000 and... Started coming down here in 2002, doing some consulting work. And then from about 2005, five on, we've right. lived here. Yeah.
How about the Dreamer horse? What's the story behind
how I got Dreamer was I was working for some folks that had I'm a big leaguer, still got I'm a big leaguer on the brain, had Hunting for Chocolate. Stanley and Susan had sold Hunting for Chocolate to Perchers, and I was working for them, and the horse was standing out here, and I was kind of overseeing all of that. A young man named Brandon Culver worked with me. He's a great young guy. Really a good young man. Anyway, and I got a chance to be around a lot of the Hunting for Chocolates. And I'm a Bodacious Dream was one of the mares that they had. And I kind of fell in love with two or three of the colts out of that mare. I really liked her colts. I started hunting Big Dreams when he was a yearling, stuff like that. Did the groundwork on him and a bunch of the other colts. And then he had a two-year-old mare. There was a two-year-old mare that she had like 90 days riding when Rusty was working for him. That he showed at the Congress in the Masters, and she was like seventh. And I mean, this filly just barely guided. Rusty and Shane, actually, they were working together then, and Shane and him put her together. But she was so kind, and she was so good-minded that, you know, that mare was really cool. Well, that was a full sister to I'm a Platinum Dream. And then most people in the horse business know about it, that Perchers had some financial problems and different issues anyway. The horse ended up being sold to Pam Bellick in California and all the brood mares and everything like that. About a year or so went by, and Pam called me and wanted to know what her lawyer actually called me and wanted to know if I would help sell her horses. She wanted to get out all that breeding stock. And I said, sure, be happy to. There was like, I think I sold 37 horses for her at the time. And I knew kind of some of the deal. I told her, I said, you know, look, I'll sell them for market value. You know, I know what you gave for them, and that they're not going to bring that. You know, I had nothing to do with the sale of the horses. So, and she was good with all of that. And I said, I would like the opportunity to buy two out of there, out of the breeding, the mare group. And she said, no problem. And I said, and I'll give you market value. And I bought I'm a Bodacious Dream and Hunting Petite Ladies, the mother to Platinum.com. And the reason that I wanted Hunting Petite Ladies was, or I'm sorry, not Hunting Petite Ladies, Zippo's Petite Lady, the mother to Hunting Petite Ladies. Zippo's Petite Lady was such a, you know, she still is, she's out here in the pasture and still got babies and all that, but she was such an honest mare. I saw her with Hillary Percher, who is Charles and Jeannie Percher's daughter, who had some physical disabilities. She's brilliant young lady and grown up now and all that. But I remembered that mare carrying her around and not taking advantage of her. You know, and it was like I like to tell people, she did the things you can't train a horse to do. You can't train a horse to make them trust you. You can't train a horse to make them take care of you. And I watched that mare carry this young girl around, and she trusted the young girl, and she took care of her. I mean, she took orders like, you know, the best rider in the world was on her, and she always did. And she still does to this day. If I need something for little kids that come to ride, Matt's little kids to ride, I grab Zippo's Petite Lady.
Was that the one you had the birthday party? I seen the pictures of that.
Little Maddie rides her, and Joel and all of them have rode her and everything like that. She's kind of the go-to girl. And she's, you know, still that way. Those are the things that are characteristic with a horse that you can't train in them. You know, and they can even be bred the same, and one will have it and one won't. But the one thing I have found is most of the time, if mama's that way, the colts will be that way. And so that's something that sticks out in my mind with mares and and the breeding and all of that. You know, it doesn't mean a lot to a lot of other people, but it does to me.
Right.
It does to me. It's a product, and it's, you know, something I want to be proud of. So I am proud of it.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess we probably
talk.
Being I got a 20-hour ride.
Yeah, you
got
to drive.
Well, I sure appreciate it.
No problem, Bart.